From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, West Michigan Congressman Justin Amash on leaving the GOP and why he believes neither party is serving America.
Unless we correct the underlying problem, which is the way the two-party system operates, you're going to have future Donald Trumps. You might have them on the right, you might have them on the left.
How we view the future of manufacturing.
Only 17% of Americans said they are very confident about that future.
And what that manufacturing future could look like in Michigan.
People don't understand manufacturing. They don't understand that it's high tech.
Manufacturing is a very healthy sector, but the workforce and the work needs are changing.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He has represented West Michigan in Congress since 2011. Today, the entire nation knows Justin Amash, thanks to his 4th of July Declaration of Independence from the Republican Party. Here with us now is Independent Congressman Justin Amash from Michigan's 3rd District. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Why now? What tipped it for you to make this step when you did?
Well, Independence Day seemed like the right day because of the symbolism of it. A lot of what I've been talking about is how we've strayed from our founding principles. We've strayed from the Constitution, separation of powers, federalism, the rule of law. And as a result, we have a culture that is more divisive. People are angry. People are, holding each other in contempt, saying they won't work with other people, they don't like other people who hold different political views. And, really it was just the right time. Things have gotten worse. The past few years have been particularly bad, at least on the Republican side, and it just seemed like the right time to do it.
Would you have left the GOP, Congressman, if Donald Trump had not been president?
Yes, I would have. And in fact, it's something I've been thinking about for a few years because I've been watching the direction of the parties, both parties. And really, it's been taken to a new level under this administration, the kind of partisan loyalty that we see. But Donald Trump is really a symptom of the problem. He didn't cause the problem. And unless we correct the underlying problem, which is the way the two-party system operates, the way it works in a very top-down fashion where a few people control the entire system, unless we fix that problem, you're going to have future Donald Trumps. You might have them on the right, you might have them on the left, but he's really a symptom of the problem, and we need to correct the overall problem.
And you've been very, very clear in everything you write and everything you say. You fear for our democracy. Do you believe the threat that you describe to our system of government, can it be solved?
It can. It can be solved, but it has to be solved from the outside. It's not going to happen on its own. I mentioned that we're in a partisan death spiral here in Congress. I don't see a way out from within the two parties. I think people at home are going to have to get involved, get engaged, understand our system, and understand what is really the problem. I think too many people today think the problem is just Donald Trump. And you have people who obviously love Donald Trump, and you have people who hate Donald Trump. And, that may seem to a lot of people to be the problem, that people are so worked up about one person. But as I mentioned, he's a symptom of the underlying problem. And unless you have a more open system of government where people come to Congress and deliberate and debate and where the outcomes are not predetermined but rather discovered through the process, until you have a system like that, you're going to continue to have these kinds of problems. You're going to continue to have extreme partisanship, and you're going to continue to have presidents like Donald Trump.
Some might wonder, why stay in Washington? As you say, you need to fix this from the outside. Why stay in Washington?
Well, I have a unique ability right now, given my position, to influence a lot of people, to go out there and talk about this. In Congress, you know, I can go on a lot of programs like this program and talk to people about it and help change people's minds. And I think that's an important thing that I can add to this process. So I want to use that position to go and convince people that there's a problem, to help them understand what the problem is. And hopefully in future generations, you won't need someone like me doing that, because people on the outside will realize what the problem is and we can correct it.
You resigned this week from your position on the House Oversight and Reform Committee and your membership in the House Republican Conference. Do you plan to caucus with the Democrats?
I don't. I'm going to be truly an independent here. I'm going to represent my constituents, and I think the party system where you're caucusing with people causes a lot of the problems we see in Washington, causes a lot of the partisan fighting, and makes people not do their jobs. I mean, it has a corrosive effect on everyone. And even someone like me, who's very independent, I felt very restricted within the party system not to speak my mind as much as I'd like to. There are times that people want to tell the public things, and they feel restricted by the fact that their colleagues are going to be upset with them. And I don't want to feel any of those kinds of restrictions. You know, I was always willing to fight those instincts, but it would cause a lot of trouble where people would get upset within the party. And I think you need someone who's going to be in Washington being open and honest and not feeling that kind of pressure from the party system.
Without caucusing with one of the two parties, as you know, it's hard to get the system to work for the constituents, if your constituents. Do you feel as now that you are a man without a party or a committee, that you can serve the people of West Michigan to the best of your abilities?
Yes, and I disagree with the premise. And this is one of the things that, I want to go out and talk about. People at home often think that things are getting done for them because people are working within a party, and they're working to, quote, get things done, or they're being, you know, effective, as people might say. And that's just not true. Most of the bills that are passed are messaging bills or don't really do much. They're largely political stunts to help people get reelected, so they can say, "Oh, I did a study for veterans," and the bill itself will do very little, but they can go run a campaign commercial on it. In fact, most of the members of Congress aren't even writing the bills that they're passing on the House floor. They're often handed the bills, depending on the need. This person's in a tight district, we'll hand him a bill so he can pass it. So, everything here is run top-down. It goes through the leadership teams of each side. The Speaker of the House has particularly a lot of control. And nothing goes through the House that does not go through the Speaker of the House. Nothing goes through your party that doesn't go through the leadership of your party. So you have very little ability to actually affect the system. And if you look around and see what kind of legislation is passed by individual members of Congress, there's very little substantive stuff that gets passed, that gets signed into law. Almost all of it is meaningless or fluff or, you know, very light changes that don't really do that much.
Can you win re-election in your district, Congressman, as an independent?
I can. I have high name ID within my district. I'm well-known within my district. I have been independent-minded for many years. I spend a lot of time talking to people in my district, and I've been working with people on both sides of the aisle for a long time. You know, when I go to town halls, it's been my goal and effort to be respectful to everyone, regardless of their political perspective. People in my district are very diverse. They have a lot of different viewpoints, but I know that we share a lot of the same principles. And when I talk to them, I talk about those principles and get people to understand that we're all Americans. We have a common foundation, and there's so much we can work on together and get done in Washington if only the system would work properly and we were able to go and deliberate and do the right thing for the people instead of the right thing for the parties.
What have you heard from everyday people calling your office or tweeting at you or talking to you on the street since you published your Declaration of Independence in the Washington Post?
So on that very day, on July 4, I went to three parades, and I walked in three parades, and the response was overwhelmingly positive. People were very supportive. People were thanking me for, you know, working independently, for, you know, trying to change the system. And I feel very good about things right now. We've gotten a lot of emails, a lot of calls, a lot of messages, and they've been overwhelmingly positive. So I feel really good about the reaction. We have a very independent district over in the 3rd District, but I really think most Americans are very independent-minded. They're not closely aligned to either of these two parties. I think most Americans find both of the parties extreme in different ways and would like to see a change in the way our system works.
We do know the DeVos family pulled its support from you after your comments about the Mueller report, and they're powerful and wealthy in West Michigan, and now you're going to be running against a member of the wealthy Meyer family. Are you confident you'll be able to raise enough money to put up a real fight without being affiliated with a party?
Very confident. Most of my fundraising over the years has been from individuals. I don't get a lot of money from PACs or sort of establishment organizations. So I've been able to go out there and reach new kinds of individuals who might not normally donate to political candidates, who might not normally get involved, and I try to get them involved in the system and in the process. So we're very confident about the ability to fundraise. And at the end of the day, fundraising isn't as important as being well-liked. And you know, I've developed a good reputation in the district because I go and speak to everyone, and I do it respectfully. And I think that carries a lot more weight than any fundraising figures or any ads I might ever run.
Congressman, would you be willing to take money from liberal-leaning groups who support your stance, this independent stance, or your potential to disrupt the president's agency and reelection chances?
So I don't traditionally turn down any person based on, you know, their affiliation. People donate to me from across the political spectrum. And, you know, there may be individual cases where I think it's not appropriate to take the funds, but you know, I'm a representative for everyone, and anyone who feels strongly about what I'm doing is welcome to donate and support me.
More with Congressman Justin Amash after the break. You're listening to Stateside. Stay with us. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's return to my conversation with Congressman Justin Amash, the newly independent representative from West Michigan. Congressman, you have not ruled out a 2020 run for president. When do you think you'll make your decision, yay or nay?
Well, it's something I get asked about a lot. I don't think I have some kind of hard deadline in the near future, but at some point, obviously, if you were to do something like run for president, you have to make a decision. So there will come a time where it gets obviously a little bit too late in the process, but we're not anywhere near that. And I'm focused on representing my district, running for reelection as an independent, and I'm honored to represent the 3rd District of Michigan, and that's really what I'd like to do.
Clearly, your editorial in the Washington Post has put you in a national spotlight. And by the way, Gary Johnson, who ran for president on the Libertarian ticket in 2016, he gives two thumbs up to the idea of you running in 2020 for president as a Libertarian. Would you ever consider that?
Well, I get asked about it, as I've mentioned, and I would never rule something like that out because any time I have an opportunity to defend the Constitution in a way that may be more effective, maybe gives me a bigger platform, I should definitely consider that. But it's not on my radar right now, and it's not my focus. My focus is on representing my district.
What are you most proud of that you've been able to do for the people in the 3rd in Congress?
I think the thing I'm most proud of is my ability to change the dialogue. You know, a lot of members of Congress spend time just bashing the other side. They go to their town halls, they go on social media, and they attack. And, you know, I'm, in many respects, a better representative today than I was when I started. I've learned a lot from early mistakes. I've come to understand what it means to be a good representative for the people. And I have to represent every single person in my district. I have to do what's right for my community, and I have to follow the Constitution every time. And I think just my ability to go out there and change the dialogue, to make people understand that people aren't good or bad just because they have different political perspectives, that people come from different backgrounds, from different experiences, and a lot of their views are developed through those experiences. And we should be respectful of people's different views. That doesn't mean we can't disagree. We can definitely disagree. We can try to point out where people have made an error in judgment from our perspective. But we should do it respectfully, and we should try to persuade people rather than trying to attack people and tear people down.
Well, I follow you on Twitter. I am looking at the banner that you have on your Twitter page. And for those who aren't familiar, it's some fascinating artwork. It's two baboons dressed in colonial wigs and ruffles. One is wearing a red coat. One is wearing a blue coat, sharp teeth bared, fingers pointed, shouting at each other, blue versus red. That artwork says a lot.
I want to say briefly about that artwork, that was a student from our district who won the Congressional Art Competition one year, and then I was able to get her permission to use that for my Twitter banner.
And by the way, it does say a lot that a student looks at that and feels that that's where we're at today.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And this was just a few years ago, and I thought this was fantastic and really, you know, depicted what's going on in Washington. So that's why I use it as my banner. But I would say that I think that it's important to do what I'm doing. I think it's more important than any individual vote I take. It's more important than, you know, being a particular party member, a Republican or a Democrat. It's more important to go out there and try to change the whole system, because if we don't correct this system, we are in big trouble as a country. And I want to go out there and spread the message and use my skills, my platform, to go and explain to people what's wrong in Washington and convince them that they have to care more about the overall process. So many people are focused on the substance of individual votes, how the outcome will affect them on that particular day, and they're missing the forest for the trees. If we don't have a good system, if we don't value our constitutional system, if we don't respect each other as a society, then it doesn't matter what the particular outcome is on any given day. Our system will fall apart and will be no different from any other country that has a bad system. So we have to stand together as Americans and uphold the traditions and system that we have here.
Can Donald Trump win Michigan in 2020?
Sure, he can win Michigan. He won the election last time, and there's no reason he couldn't win again. I don't think people should take him for granted. I think he is a strong campaigner. I think he really knows how to push people's buttons, and he can motivate a pretty significant segment of the population. So I wouldn't, say that he has no chance. He's down in the polls, but, you know, he's surprised people before, and people shouldn't take him lightly.
What does it mean for our country if he is reelected?
Well, it means that there's still a divide in our country. I think we need different kinds of candidates than we're getting right now. You know, I don't know that any of the people running against him right now would try to divide people as much as he's been doing it. But, I think we need a very different approach to politics. We need people to return to civility, to be respectful to each other. And in that sense, Donald Trump has been extremely damaging. He's taken things that were bad, the partisan divide, and he's made it worse. So I'd like to see someone elected to the presidency who's going to return us to a system of respect and trust. And even if we have differences on some positions, we need people to be able to work together and talk kindly to each other and, frankly, to love each other.
And maybe someday you'll be able to replace that banner on your Twitter page.
I'd love to do that.
Congressman Justin Amash, independent from Michigan's 3rd District, thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Artificial intelligence was once the stuff of science fiction, like Whopper from the 1983 film War Games.
I'll ask it how it feels. I'm fine. How are you?
Excellent. It's been a long time. Shall we play a game?
But today, artificial intelligence is nothing like that, and it is a part of everyday life, like asking Siri to call your mom or ordering Alexa to reorder toilet paper. AI is also becoming increasingly essential to businesses. Ann Arbor-based Clink AI recently raised more than $50 million in investment to expand their efforts to create customized AI programs for businesses. Here to tell us more about AI in Michigan's tech landscape is Lingjia Tang, who's co-founder and COO of Clink AI. Lingjia, for those of us who are not steeped in computer science and artificial intelligence, tell us just what Clink AI does for businesses. What problem does your business solve?
We're a software company that creates conversational experience for other business. For example, think about Siri and Google Assistant. In the last 15 years, that experience hasn't really changed much for anyone, right?
No,
you could actually ask questions like, you know, weather or, you know, set a timer, but you can't really have a real conversation with your virtual assistant. So this is where Clink comes in, where we build sophisticated conversational AI experience where you could have a real conversation, you could ask questions and multi-turn, and you could ask multiple domain about your life. One of the focus we've been working on is personal finance management. We collaborate with multiple major banks and provide a solution where user can ask questions about their bank account. You could ask questions like, how much money did I spend on shoes? You could ask questions in a very casual way, just like you're talking to a friend. You know, I just went to Las Vegas. I wonder how much money I actually spent there. Or does it make sense for me to take my friends for a $400 dinner?
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a conversation. You could say, open my account. I think I have a fraud. I got an email. So you don't have to worry about how you talk to them.
Is this artificial intelligence for just plain folks, or is it more designed for companies and businesses?
So Clink is a B2B2C model, which means that we basically work with a lot of enterprises to actually provide solutions for the end customers. We work with a USAA, for example, then we basically provide solutions for USAA's customers.
So if I'm a small business, how might I use Clink?
There are a few things we provide. One is the key product is an AI platform. It's a software stack with very nice user interface for an average developer or even people who don't have much of developer experience can actually get a developer license and basically build conversation experience using that particular tool. There is a few pre-built competencies that are already in the platform so everybody can download and play with it.
So how would my company use it? What would I do with it?
Having a conversation with technology is the future of how people interact with technology. We use keyboard, we use mouse. None of those is actually very intuitive. You know, you want to wake up in the morning and say, tell me about my calendar and how's my finance doing? Do I have any travel up? You basically have those questions, right? So let's say you have a small business, you potentially have digital channel where you actually interact with the customers. You could say, hey, I want to turn this user experience into a more conversation experience with customers, then you could actually download the platform and build the whatever conversation experience you want your users to have. We have very nice API, just integrate into your mobile app, into your Facebook Messenger, into your call center, however a common way, digital and non-digital, that you typically interact with customers with nowadays, that you could integrate that the new virtual assistant into your current solutions.
So that would be used perhaps a company with its customers and also for internal company
communications? Oh, absolutely.
How so?
Yeah, one of the use cases that we've been building out for a major bank is actually one of the HR cases. Employee have a lot of questions about, hey, what's my 401k? You know, how do I do that? Do I have PTOs? You know, all those questions can be handled by virtual assistant, basically provide answers and multi-turn. Another example is seeing small business, you want to check inventory and say, hey, I don't know how much is in stock right now. Like, let me know. So virtual assistant experience can be integrated into your digital inventory system and answer those questions for you.
So rather than clicking away with a mouse and typing, I just talk.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
briefly tell us about how your company started. It was on the U of M campus, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. So the funny story. So both Jason and I.
And Jason is?
Is the CEO and one of the co-founders as well. We are professors in computer science in U of M. We built this open source tool called Osirius back in 2013 and 14. We put it online and it was on GitHub. It was downloaded tens of thousands of times the first month we actually put it on. So we started to get phone calls from Wells Fargo, Ford, GE, all those companies says, oh, please, we love this. We will want you to build this for us for a domain-specific virtual assistant. We were professors at the time, and I didn't have the bandwidth to do that. So I was 9 months pregnant, and I told my husband that we should start a company, hire one programmer, just handle the load, you know, because there's a demand in there. 2 weeks after my baby was born, Jason, my husband, actually we're married, my co-founder, I registered for the company, so I had two babies at the same time.
New company, you know? New baby.
I know.
How many people do you employ now?
Right now, we have 100 people on payroll, 85 in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And obviously, things are working because I know you've raised $52 million in your second round of investments.
Yeah.
How does it feel to have this thing starting from the seed that was planted back in 2014, and it is attracting investment money? It's becoming a thing.
It's very exciting. As I said, at the time when we started the company, we were like, let's hire one programmer.
Now you've got 100 employees. You are the kind of tech company, Lingjia, that I think every politician, every economic developer, every pundit talks about attracting and retaining to help grow a strong local and strong state economy. Did you have offers to leave Michigan and maybe head to one of the coasts or Chicago or anywhere else?
I want the headquarters always in Michigan. I love this area. I think it's actually often overlooked for talent and the passion of the people here. We actually, both Jason and I, moved from San Diego to Michigan. And at the time, the San Diego local newspaper were having this report about how do we actually lose talent to Michigan. I think it's very underestimated, undervalued Michigan talent. When I came here, I was very, very surprised and actually very glad to see the talent here. It's a lot of actually passion in the area for technology. So I want to stay. We plan to stay and grow the technology here.
Is there anything you have to kind of work a little harder to do because you're in Michigan?
Yeah, I actually think a lot of senior talent are still actually in the process, potentially thinking about moving back to Michigan, but they're still on the coast side. But I think we're building the ecosystem here. We have more and more companies here. We have more capital coming to Midwest. We're building the ecosystem up, and then I think that challenge will be addressed soon.
As a tech entrepreneur who is building this company in Michigan, you've got a really clear view of our startup and our tech economies. What do we need to be doing a better job of as a state if we want to attract more entrepreneurs like you and companies like yours?
I think the state government can actually help with the incentive programs. People ask me to move to Ohio sometimes because of the Ohio actually incentive, and I think the Michigan can do actually to compete with the surrounding, because we have a lot of talents here with the university, but it would be great to say, hey, here is a zone for business, and that's actually have incentive plan to actually have people actually coming back.
When you go and try to hire people from out of state to come be in Michigan with us, what do they say?
I think one of the concerns is whether we have an ecosystem here, because when people want to move, they want to move to a place that have a lot of opportunities. They could love one company, but they're always in the back of their mind thinking about, what if it doesn't work out? Can I actually go to somewhere else? So the more companies we have, more capital we have, more visibility we have, the easier to actually attract people. But it's not all bleak, because we successfully attract a lot of people to here. I think the key is whenever I try to recruit people, I say, look, just come here for a visit, spend a few days here. And we actually managed to recruit a lot of senior talents from all over the world actually to come to Ann Arbor. They say, oh my God, I didn't know that Michigan is this great. There's so much stuff going on. It's so beautiful. And I say that, you know, then we need to actually work on our visibility and PR to actually, you know, market Michigan as a tech center a bit better, you know, because people actually do come and they walk away very impressed.
If things go right, as you're hoping they are, you're building this head of steam with Clink AI, what's your timetable in terms of growth? How big do you think your company can get?
You know, in a VC world, in a software company, whether they like to say triple, triple, double, double, which means that the revenue growth have to triple in the first 3 years and then double in the next 2 years, and this is how you get to $100 million. In the last year, we quadrupled our revenue, and so we're on track to triple this year. With that timetable, roughly 3 years, we'll get to $100 million revenue and IPO from that point on, and that's the timetable we're shooting for now.
Are you firmly committed to staying in Michigan? Would anything get you to leave Michigan?
I will never leave Michigan. We may have offices somewhere else, but I'm very passionate about, you know, Michigan, the university, and Ann Arbor, this area, and Detroit area.
Ling Zhetang is co-founder and COO of Clink AI. The Ann Arbor-based tech firm has raised $52 million in its second round of investments, improving on artificial intelligence and virtual assistants and giving Siri a real run for her money. Thank you. It was
a
pleasure to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a new survey from the Brookings Institution finds Americans value manufacturing as vital to the U.S. economy, but it's unclear what the role is of manufacturing in the future of our economy.
People are not quite so convinced that the future is going to be bright for this segment.
We'll hear about those findings and also talk to a couple Michigan business leaders about how the manufacturing sector is shifting in our state. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Americans like to see ourselves as builders, manufacturers, as can-do people. And history supports that view. Certainly, Michigan can point to its auto companies, to being the arsenal of democracy in producing thousands of B-24 Liberator bombers in World War II. The U.S. Census tells us 11.1 million people work in manufacturing, generating $5.4 trillion every year in economic activity. But a new Brookings Institution survey finds when we look into the future, that important role of manufacturing doesn't look quite so vital. Daryl West is here with us to explain. Among his many titles at Brookings, he is Vice President of Governance Studies. He's also the author of The Future of Work, Robots, AI, and Automation. Daryl, what are the key findings and takeaways from your survey?
Well, it's a good news, bad news situation. The good news is 58% of Americans believe that manufacturing is very important to the American economy, and I think that should be reassuring to people in the Midwest where manufacturing plays such a strong role. But the bad news is we also ask about the future of manufacturing. Only 17% of Americans said they are very confident about that future.
That is a whopping disconnect, if I can just say, from 58% saying it's vital to only 17% confident in the future. Are these trends alarming?
They are alarming to me. We certainly believe manufacturing is part of the bedrock of the American economy. There are many middle-class Americans that depend on manufacturing for their livelihoods. We asked what some of the biggest barriers were to manufacturing, and the largest number, 23% cited government regulations, 21% said poorly trained workers, 14% named high taxes, and 8% said energy costs. So there are a variety of barriers that people worry about as we move into the future.
Your survey finds that, as you pointed out, more people in the Midwest are confident about the future of manufacturing than in other parts of the country. But still, it's a pretty small share of the population here feeling confident about the future of manufacturing. Would you have expected to see more confidence in the Midwest than you found? Or do you think Midwesterners are kind of snake bit, kind of skeptical of the future because we have really seen the ups and downs of the manufacturing sector firsthand?
I would have liked to have seen better numbers in the Midwest. I actually grew up in the Midwest, grew up in Ohio, and so saw the importance of manufacturing in my youth. And people in the Midwest are a little more optimistic about the future of manufacturing, but not really by that much. So there really was not stark regional differences.
Interesting. And you also had some interesting findings in whether anyone would encourage a young person today to get a job in the manufacturing sector.
We did. we certainly think that there are great opportunities for young people in the manufacturing sector. A lot of people have this old image of factories and warehouses as being dirty places and not a good place to work. But in fact, you know, manufacturing has reinvented itself. It's taken on digital tools. It's pretty high tech in terms of what we think. But there are some people who do think that manufacturing is a great place for young people to enter, but the numbers are not as big as one might think.
Daryl, what do you learn from the survey as far as what people think manufacturing will look like in the future? Will we be seeing the autos and the auto suppliers that we know so well in Michigan, or are we moving increasingly to automation and to tech companies?
Automation certainly is coming into the manufacturing sector. 64% of the people in our survey said that they think there's going to be lots of automation in manufacturing 10 years from now. So they can see the rise of robotics. There already are a large number of robots that are engaged in the manufacturing sector. People think that is a trend that is likely to continue in the future. So I think people are a little worried about the labor force ramifications of all the automation that is coming into manufacturing.
It certainly sounds like we could be looking at this automated future with plenty more jobs in the executive suite than on the floors of the plants.
That certainly is a risk. And in my book, The Future of Work, I argue that we really need to emphasize worker retraining because there are going to be some people who are going to lose jobs. We don't want them to fall to the wayside. So we're going to need to provide job retraining programs for them. We need to invest in lifetime learning because we know automation is also going to create jobs, but the jobs are going to require different types of skills than many people have right now. So it's going to be important for people to take online courses, get certified as having a particular skill so that they can stay up to date as the workforce demands change.
Daryl, where are we seeing growth in the manufacturing sector?
There's a lot of growth in a number of different areas. Certainly the automotive sector, which I know is very important in Michigan, is going to continue to be quite robust. But it could change in the sense that autonomous vehicles are going to be coming into that sector. There's a growth of the ride-sharing services. Certainly many young people who live in major cities are not owning cars. The car ownership levels among young people is smaller than what we see for older age groups. So the auto companies are going to have to reinvent themselves in terms of the types of vehicles that they make, as well as the part of the market niche that they are going to serve. So that will have big ramifications for manufacturing in general.
Daryl, finally, just given the results of this survey and certainly your field of research, what do you say to Michigan about the future of our manufacturing and our statewide economy?
I mean, it's like every other sector that the future will be as bright as the resources that we put into it. So I think manufacturing historically has been a vital part of the American economy. It still can be vital, but we need to invest in worker retraining, in education, and in infrastructure. Like manufacturing depends a lot on highways, on rail and air transport. And America has been falling behind in its infrastructure investments. So that, you know, if we really want to have a bright future for manufacturing, we need to invest a lot more in infrastructure.
Daryl West is with the Brookings Institution, where he directs the Center for Technology Innovation and also directs the John Hazen White Manufacturing Initiative. He's the author of The Future of Work, Robots, AI, and Automation. Daryl, thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you.
We'd like to continue now the conversation about the future of manufacturing and its vitality to the U.S. economy. Here now are two Michigan business leaders who thought a lot about this. Mike Coast is president of the Michigan Manufacturing Technology Center, and Sandy Barua, president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. Mike, I want to start by asking you how you think workers and executives in the manufacturing sector view the health of manufacturing in Michigan, and how confident are they about its future?
I think they view it as a very positive light. You know, the manufacturers that are out there, and we deal mostly with the small to medium-sized manufacturers, companies that have under 500 employees per plant, and they're well-suited to make a run coming down the road. You know, Industry 4.0 is going to be a big topic for not only the big companies but the small companies. It's going to transfer the manufacturing industry as a whole. They're going to have a whole new skill set that they're going to have to deal with, and they're going to have to try and figure out how to work with new people and train new people in this new economy for things that are coming down the road.
And what does that look like? How can your members best retool for changes in the economy and in demand? As you say, you look ahead to Industry 4.0.
Well, Industry 4.0 is this digitization that's going to occur. And the big companies can afford to go out and spend a lot of money. The smaller companies don't have those kinds of budgets. But there are a lot of things that are out there right now that they can adapt and implement. I try and think of it not just as Industry 4.0, but as lean technology. So they can take sensors, and the prices of sensors have dropped dramatically over the years. And so they can go in and sensor up a machine and make that machine more efficient and track a lot of the things that are going on with it. And we can show them how to do that. We actually have an Industry 4.0 lab at our facility where we've identified 9 technologies so that these small manufacturing companies can come in. They can play with the technology. They can play with a 3D printer. They can play with a light guide system for augmented reality, and they can see how it applies to their manufacturing facilities or machines that they want to work on. And so then they can make the investment. No, by the way, they don't have to make multi-million-dollar investments. They can make, you know, incremental investments, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, and they can start to make changes in their facilities. And then as they free up capital, they can make more investments and just keep on going.
Sandy Barua, over to you. How do you view the changing role of manufacturing in the overall economic health of Michigan?
I think the first thing to understand, especially about the Brookings study, was that it was a public opinion survey. And as Mike knows so well, there is an incredible amount of data focused on the manufacturing sector and manufacturing employment. So in a nutshell, obviously manufacturing employment, it looks very different today than it did in the early 1970s, late 1960s, right? I mean, we've lost about, 7 million manufacturing jobs since the peak of about 1973 nationwide. However, manufacturing output is incredibly strong. We're actually producing more manufacturing output in the United States and in Michigan, frankly, than we have just about any time in our history. It's just that the employment base looks very different.
And so looking ahead then, as for the overall economic health of Michigan, what do you see the kinds of changes that Mike was even talking about? How do you view that? Will it keep Michigan, will it be a healthy situation for Michigan?
Absolutely. In fact, Mike's description of manufacturing 4.0 is spot on, and there's really no industry that personifies that better than the automotive / mobility industry. When you look at what the mobility industry, the future is going to be, it is going to be more heavily technology dependent than we can even imagine today. And when you think about what a manufacturing job looks like today and tomorrow, it's very different than what it looked like in 1960. Mm-hmm. It is not this, dirty, dangerous, kind of factory, noisy environment. It is going to be a very technologically advanced. And that's where the skill difference really comes into play here. In the 1960s, you could just have a high school degree, have a successful manufacturing career. Now, and I'm sure Mike will attest to this, you need a professional skills certificate, a 2-year associate's degree, to really be successful in today's high-tech manufacturing industry.
That Brookings survey found that only 19% of people in the Midwest are very confident about the future of manufacturing. Are people in the Midwest just feeling snake bit after, in the wake of the Great Recession? What do you think, Mike?
There's this perception, image, that manufacturing is this dirty industry that's out there. In Michigan, Michigan leads the country in the number of manufacturing events that occur on Manufacturing Day in October. We lead the nation. States like California have 3 times as many manufacturers that we do. And we lead the nation in a number of events. And I have an unofficial number that we actually had about 11,534 kids that went through manufacturing plants the last manufacturing day.
So why do you think people aren't picking up on that? As you say, it's a public opinion survey. So what do you think people are missing?
People don't understand manufacturing. They don't understand the stuff that Sandy said. They don't understand that it's high tech, that you can go into a manufacturing company and you can get a job as a CAD/CAM operator working on a computer, and that's a high tech job. Or you can get a job designing molds that is a high tech job, or in sales, and it's a high tech job. And oh, by the way, all those skills that those people pick up that Sandy talked about, those are transferable skills to other industries. So they're educating young people nowadays to go out and work. And a lot of people simply don't know that there are great jobs and great opportunities in a manufacturing facilities nowadays.
Sandy, you have said in the past that you don't believe automation is a larger concern to the health of the economy and jobs because market forces, you believe, will create jobs in new sectors and widen opportunity in other areas. Is that a hard sell to someone who spent their whole life working in manufacturing and has seen their job eliminated?
Well, of course it is. And we have to have programs and, most importantly, compassion for people who were doing something and that job has now become automated. We're going to see more and more of that. That puts the onus on society, on government, on large corporations to find ways to retrain workers so they can keep current on their skills. The environment that we once were in where you could learn a craft or a skill and you could deploy that one skill or craft for 20 or 25 years uninterrupted, those days are over. The technology is moving too fast. The pace of change is moving too fast. And if I could just go back for a second with the dialogue you just had with Mike about, you know, why people in the Midwest and other regions of the country are maybe pessimistic about manufacturing, it really comes down to most people view the health of an industry based on the number of people working in it. And if that is the guide, then we would say that agriculture in the United States is a unsuccessful industry because we have a fraction, I mean just a very small fraction of people working in agriculture today than we did at the turn of the last century, yet our agriculture output has exploded. You know, because of technology, because of advancements. We're seeing the same thing in manufacturing. Manufacturing is a very healthy sector, but the workforce and the work needs are changing.
And to that point, are education and training sectors in Michigan keeping up with the needs of Industry 4.0? Mike, I'll let you take it first.
They're keeping up. They're starting to change. I think the apprenticeship programs in the state were behind a few years ago, and now they're starting to catch up. Mm-hmm. So training these people is absolutely a key. If I might, I would regress a little bit. There's a manufacturing company that we worked with that increased the number of employees that they had by 10%. So they grew a good 10%, but their productivity is Sandy was pointed out, increased tenfold. And oh, by the way, the hourly wage rate went up another 30%. So the people were making more money, they have a higher output, and now that company is now very competitive in the marketplace. And oh, by the way, the question about the training, he's had to train his internal people so that they can make their machines run faster. In the old days, you would go out and you'd set up a machine and let it run. I was in the same plant talking to a young man running a manufacturing cell that had three CNC machines and robots attached to it. And I asked him what he was working on. He said, these two machines are working pretty good right now, but I got to tweak this one over here and make that machine more interactive with the other two so I can get more productivity out. That's a high-skilled job. That's a high-paying job. And you didn't find those kind of jobs years ago.
Sandy, you get the final few seconds. Are we keeping up with the needs of Industry 4.0 as we train our workers?
I'm a little concerned. The percentage, both the percentage and the raw number of high school graduates that go into either a professional skills certificate path or a two-year or four-year pathway is actually declining in Michigan, and we need to be going the other direction. In order for us to fill the needs that our companies have, manufacturing or others, we need to have more people with professional degree certificates, two-year and four-year degrees from community college or four-year institutions, and we're kind of going the wrong way.
Sandy Barua, President and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber, and Mike Coast is President of Michigan Manufacturing Technology Center. Great talking with both of you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, Bella Isaacs, Adam Reyes, Anna Schlute, and Rebecca Tauber. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.